Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we are taking a look at the DNC leaks, but don't worry, we won't be getting bogged down in the same old angles. Instead, we're going to chat to Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai from Vice Motherboard about his experience in interviewing the Gucci for Two persona. Then we'll be hearing from Kevin Paulson about what these latest developments could mean for WikiLeaks. We'll also be having a chat about the concept of non-linear information warfare. That'll be fun. And we can't do that without setting some context around this whole drama that seems to have been completely ignored by the rest of the media. I know it's a topic you're probably sick of hearing about this week, but do stick with us here on Risky Business. We've got some new angles, and I think they're pretty relevant. This week's sponsor interview is an absolute certified 24-carat cracker. Bromium is this week's sponsor, and its CTO and co-founder, Simon Crosby, will be along to talk about his experience in dealing with the wrath of Tavis Ormandy. Tavis actually managed to dig a custom build of Bromium software out of VirusTotal, which is a novel way to get someone's software, and he found a really cool bug. But there's actually a fair bit more to that story than people have heard so far, and Simon will be filling us in on all of that a little bit later on in the show. But before we get into all of that, it's time, of course, for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, of course, we are covering the DNC leaks and the Russia angle in this week's feature slot, but there is more WikiLeaks news this week. The so-called Erdogan emails said to have been obtained from Turkey's AKP party have been dumped by WikiLeaks, but they appear to be anything but actual Erdogan emails, if you're to believe some of the headlines flying around.
Yeah, it does seem that a significant portion of the mail spool is kind of people emailing into the government and all of the usual sorts of spam and things that you would expect, rather than emails between, you know, influential political party people in that country. So yeah, it doesn't look quite as, you know, as juicy as it first seemed, I suppose, or at least, you know, the fact that it's all in Turkish and a lot of us, you know, we don't read and write Turkish, so it becomes a little more difficult for us to assess it as quickly as we might have, you know, the DNC emails, for example. Mm-hmm. Some of the analysis we saw criticized was one paper in the US claimed there were 1,400 emails relating to the particular kind of cleric that lives in the US that Erdogan says was involved in organizing the coup. And it turned out that's also the Turkish word for smile.
Gulen,
1,400 emails about smiling rather than it being about that particular person. So, like, I mean, clearly the quality of the analysis so far has not been great. And then as people who kind of know the scene in that country are looking into it, it does appear that there's a whole bunch of stuff in that set of data that you really actually didn't want to publish on the internet in quite such a rush.
Well, I'll tell you who does speak Turkish, which is Zeynep Tufekci, I think, or Tufekci. I'm not sure how to pronounce that, but she is an associate professor at the School of Information and Library Science at the University of North Carolina and a sometime author of various pieces for various media outlets. And they did a write-up for Huffington Post in which they say that WikiLeaks has put millions of women in Turkey in danger for absolutely no reason. Apparently, in the data dump, there were spreadsheets containing information on millions of women, Zeynep has said. And this led to a rather entertaining thread on Twitter between Zeynep and WikiLeaks themselves.
Yeah, apparently this data is voter records for women in 79 out of 81 provinces in Turkey, including like phone numbers, addresses, so the sort of the Turkish equivalent of a social security number. Like it's a big deal for people in that country and for the people in that data leak. And yeah, it has been validated as being actual, you know, legitimate, correct data and current for a lot of the people that are in it. So yeah, it's a really big deal. And I guess the fallout from this really does make WikiLeaks's action, you know, and dumping this so quickly, and clearly, you know, I don't think anyone is surprised that they, you know, that they acted on this very quickly given the circumstances unfolding in Turkey. But it may be the case that they acted a little bit too quickly in dumping this without really understanding necessarily what was in it.
You keep saying they, and I think pretty much at this point WikiLeaks is one guy in a room with a cat. So, you know, the lack of resources might explain to some degree what's happening here.
Yeah, well, yeah, certainly that. I mean, I guess Julian's been, you know, stuck in a fairly small room for quite a long time. And, you know,
he doesn't get out much these days, you might say.
Well, yeah. But yeah, it's not looking good. And I guess another interesting twist to this story is that the person who actually hacked the AKP and obtained this data has shown up in a post linked to by none other than Phineas Fisher, the Gamma Group PR account on Twitter, linked to a paste bin which, you know, claimed responsibility, explained some backstory, said that it was only half of the email that had been provided and that he was in there in the middle of the network downloading stuff when WikiLeaks dropped, despite them being kind of asked not to because, you know, things were still afoot. And it's not, it's really not clear that this is attributing this to Phineas Fisher.
Yeah, look, Vice wrote up a story saying Phineas Fisher claimed credit for this. But if you look at the tweet that they based the story on, they're kind of just linking to it. And then the pastes at, you know, after you make the jump, claim credit. So yeah, I'm not really sure that this story is accurate. It's a bit confusing, isn't it?
Yeah. It's not clear that Phineas Fisher is taking responsibility. It does not say, I specifically, Phineas Fisher, did this thing. It's not
being of sound mind and body on the 25th. Yes. Well, look, I mean, let's turn to some actual, you know, great coverage now of what's been happening in Turkey. And Bellingcat, which is the, you know, it's like a citizen journalist OSINT site, and they occasionally publish some very, very interesting stuff. And they got a hold of the WhatsApp thread. You remember last week we spoke about this. The coup in Turkey was apparently planned via WhatsApp. You know, let's go overthrow the government, smiley face. They've obtained the whole thread and they've analyzed it and collated it against, you know, images from the ground. And, you know, I mean, look, if you're looking for a good blow-by-blow on how things actually went down during the coup, I mean, this is the attempted coup, this is it. I mean, this is great work.
It really is. And it's a really great example of the power of, you know, of OSN and of, you know, this kind of correlation. You know, this is a quality of report you would expect to get out of national intelligence functions,
yeah,
you know, with,
yeah,
access to traditional comms. But because now it's WhatsApp, and literally the source for this data that they're pulling together was someone posted a video on YouTube scrolling through a phone of a guy that they had captured in Turkey, like someone who was part of the coupist side had been captured, and they were literally scrolling through his phone, recording it with another phone, uploaded that to YouTube, and that's the primary source material, and they correlated with some other captured devices and records and things. But I mean, the quality of the analysis and the data you can get out of it is, you know, I imagine that there are SIGINT agencies that work for national governments that can't deliver this kind of quality information. So that's pretty cool.
No, very cool. And I would suggest that if you do obtain some, you know, leaks, maybe send it to these guys.
You know? Yeah, well, certainly they did really great work with the Ukraine, you know, the flight being shot down in the Ukraine by the Russians. I mean, their analysis of that was really in-depth and ongoing,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, still. No, they did some award-winning work on MH17. So, yeah, just look, everybody go check out Bellingcat, long story short. Now, it's not just WikiLeaks jumping the shark this week. hey, in Soviet Russia, shark jump you. Hey, boom, tish. Snowden. Snowden has a solution for things. he's proposing a device to warn if your iPhone's radios are transmitting. This is like okay, so what he's basically proposing here is a product. It's like an iPhone case with a display on the back of it, and you have to have an expert technician wire it into your phone. And then basically what it does is when you put your phone into flight mode, it will tell you if the radios are on because reasons.
Yeah, I mean,
basically what he's done is he's developed a device which will give you less safety than removing the battery from your phone. The whole idea of this is to avoid active tracking via GPS. But if you just take the battery out of your phone, you can also avoid tracking via GPS.
Well, yes, but then you can't have an iPhone because the battery doesn't come out.
But look, I'm guessing if you have an expert technician install this phone case, you could probably have an expert technician install a on-off switch as well.
That you make a good point, actually.
Or you could leave your phone at home, which might also
be a good idea.
Well, I mean, that sends another signal, I guess. But anyway, no, I mean, this device doesn't actually exist. It's Snowden and Bunny Huang have been kind of collaborating on the design, and they've made a mock-up, you know, like a visual mock-up of it, not an actual hardware mock-up of it. But yes, it doesn't seem like the world's most practical solution versus just buying an Android that you can take the battery out of.
Yeah, so, and the other thing I don't get is, like, it doesn't actually stop your phone from transmitting your location. It just might tell you that it has. Which, you know, I don't know, maybe it gives you a bit of a head start on the drone, you know?
Well, and I mean, it's not like it has to immediately radio out. Like, I mean, it could just store it until you turn flight mode off and then send your things like everything else. I mean, it's just,
But it will tell you when the GPS's info is, when the GPS is active. So that's kind of useful. But it's not, I don't get what problem this is trying to solve. Do you know what I mean? Like, it sort of demonstrates a lack of understanding of what actual risks are. And when I was spouting off about this on Twitter, Asher Wolf, who is a, you know, hacktivist type who is, you know, has quite a following on Twitter, actually said, well, maybe it's useful for refugees crossing borders or people going to protests. And I'm just thinking, what? Those refugees who have access to, you know, expert technicians to install their anti-tracking device before they cross borders? I just don't understand.
On their iPhone 6.
Yeah, I don't really get it, you know, and Snowden's kind of been called on some other shit this week. He was talking about how, hey, you know, the NSA could attribute responsibility for the DNC attack because they can use X key score. I did this personally against Chinese operations. And we've seen, and I've kind of been expecting this for a while, we've seen an X Siginter actually call him on it on Twitter and just say, look, since my colleagues are afraid to comment, this is ridiculous. Also, weren't you in T Group? Just stop. So, yeah, interesting this week. Interesting week for Snowden.
Not being a Siginter or an NSA person myself, I don't actually know what T Group is. There seems to be some suggestion it might be help desk, or it might actually be, you know, kind of telco comms-y stuff. I'm not quite sure. But either way, some ex-NSAs do appear to be, giving him a bit of a hard time this week.
Yes, indeed. Moving on, and I love this, man. This is like, we haven't seen anything like this since Biggie versus Tupac, man. I love it. These ransomware crews are like dueling and dropping each other's keys. I love this.
Yeah, apparently this ransomware crew called Misha, who stole some source code and key material from another ransomware project called Chimera. They used their code in their own piece of ransomware and then dropped the Chimera crew's keys so that people can decrypt their malware, you know, decrypt their ransomware, and get their files back, which is pretty, as you said, pretty funny and a good East Coast, West Coast of Russia malware crews duking it out on the streets.
And moving on to this week in marketing genius, Sentinel-1, where Jeremiah Grossman works these days, they're offering a $1 million guarantee to stop ransomware, which is, look, I know it's marketing, but you got to love it where people put their money where their mouth is.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly your first reaction to this is like, oh, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. But if the other vendors that made awful products that got people owned worse than the thing they were protecting, you know, meant to be protecting their customers from, did this, then maybe the world would be a better place. So yeah, it's my initial reaction, I think I have now walked back in favor of actually, yeah, why not? Yeah. Although quite how this interacts with the business models of ransomware operators, I'm not quite sure. Like, they're going to start targeting people using this because they're more likely to pay out. Like,
we'd like our $1 million, please. I'm sorry, sir. We don't take Ethereum. The EFF is suing the United States over the DMCA's restrictions on security research, which is kind of interesting. Way to do something useful, guys. Nicely done.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. I mean, the restrictions against reverse engineering under the DMCA, and, you know, specifically focused on stopping people from circumventing copyright controls on, you know, like the DVD CSS code, I guess, was one high-profile example. But, yeah, so the usual people are involved. Matthew Green. And seems to be very busy these days. Bunny Huang again, talking through the challenges that those restrictions of the DMCA pose for their research. So we'll be interesting to see where the EFF actually gets somewhere. You know, it's been in law for a long time. It's about time they killed it. But maybe if they were gonna, it would have happened by now.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. NIST has issued some guidance around SMS-based two-factor authentication. They say it's time to start thinking of other approaches. And you know, we've been heading in that direction for quite a while. I mean, if you take a trip to South Africa and talk to the banking people over there and the telco people, and you look at what happens with the amount of SIM swap fraud that they experience, you know, this has been on the cards for a while, but it's, I think it's kind of good that NIST is issuing guidance here and saying, yeah, look, let's think of another way, please.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it is not the world's most robust second factor option. And yeah, there's a myriad attacks against against both the phone infrastructure and then the phone company's mechanisms of tying individual people to their accounts and SIM cards and SIM swapping and yeah, all those kinds of things. So yes, it's good to see that in the latest draft of their digital authentication guidelines, NIST are suggesting that we move away from it. You know, that'll take a little while. Of course, there's lots of applications that are well embedded into SMS for second factor. But yeah, it's time.
Yeah, I wonder if the guys over at Duo, like, you know, who they delivered the suitcase full of cash to get this.
Yeah, they're rubbing their hands together.
LastPass, the password manager, having all sorts of grief this week.
Yeah, someone posted a bug in LastPass that let you basically just steal other people's credentials, other sites' credentials off people via, you know, a stupid URL parsing bug in the kind of client-side code that LastPass injects into web pages to be able to then populate them with your password. So web-based password manager, perhaps not the world's best idea being illustrated here. To their credit, they did turn around a patch for this particular bug in a day, which is nice, and paid out $1,000 bug bounty to the guy who found it. So good for him, and I guess good for them for fixing it rapidly. The other bad day they're having is, of course, the world's, you know, worst man, if you're a security software vendor, Mr. Tavis Ormandy has also been rolling on LastPass and has been destroying there. Apparently they have like a FAT client for Windows, like an actual binary for Windows that runs and interacts with your Firefox to do LastPass-y things. Tavis has been destroying that. LastPass are in the process of fixing that as well, although the general scuttlebutt seems to be that their, you know, their FAT client LastPass is awful anyway, so just stay away from that.
Oh, a bit of fun for people who are responsible for SAP infrastructure. There are 15 vulnerabilities being outlined in SAP HANA. That's going to be a lot of fun for all of you. But look, here's an interesting story. Firefox has announced that it's planning to block Flash in August and completely disable it in 2017. So the end is actually here. And I'm sure there are many people who are quite happy with that, because usually what happens is one browser does it and then the other ones follow.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Chrome's had Flash click to run by default for a while now, and Firefox is going to follow into that. And then, yes, the eventual death of Flash very soon after. So, hurrah.
Yeah, so they're gonna put it into a comatose state first before they put the bullet into it. Flash is sleeping, it won't feel a thing, I think, basically, is the moral of this story. And finally, Adam, this week, this is hilarious. PetNet Cloud Pet Care. I don't even know where to start with this. I'm just going to hand it over to you.
Yeah, so you've got a pet and you want to feed it like biscuits. And instead of just giving it the biscuits yourself, you instead buy an Internet of Things connected pet feeding thing, Internet. And then they get DOSed or have some other bad time on their back end server, and your pet doesn't get fed anymore. And normally we would call this the skateboarding dog story, but I guess the dog won't be skateboarding because he's dead.
Well, he'll either be hungry or dead. Yes, that's right. And shame on you, DDoS people, for disrupting the cloud pet feeding service. What I find hilarious about this is this PetNet cloud-based pet feeding service sounds like one of those really f***ing stupid .com ideas from the 90s.
And it so does.
You know, and we all thought they were so stupid, and here we are 20 years later, and it's actually our reality.
I don't know how we got. What did we do to deserve this? Internet connected pet feeding. I mean, really.
None of us in technology deserve nice things. That's what I've decided.
No, we really don't. Ruined everything. Just feed your cat, for Christ's sake, don't.
Exactly. Spend some time with the thing. Like Julian. Exactly. Be like Julian. Spend some time with your cat. Oh, shit. All right. That's actually it for this week's news. I am, of course, off to Las Vegas next week. So we probably won't get a chance to speak then, but we'll chat to you again in a couple of weeks.
We'll talk to you then, Patsy.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there. And yes, I am off to Las Vegas next week, so I'll see you all there, those of you who are coming. And if anyone wants to meet up and say hi, just keep an eye on my Twitter. I think the most likely thing I'm going to do is I'll just be tweeting out my location here and there. So, you know, if listeners want to say hi and have a beer or a juice or whatever, they can. One of the things I enjoy most about conferences is actually meeting people who listen to the show. So do keep an eye out for me on Twitter and in the meat space. And my username is just Risky Business, one word. Don't be shy. Come and say hello. Okay, we're going to dive into the DNC leaks thing now. News first broke about a Russian state-sponsored attack into the DNC's network in mid-June. The Washington Post had the story. CrowdStrike published its findings with the DNC's blessing, but the story basically didn't go anywhere. But some waves were made in the tech press when a website and social media account sprung up in the name of Gucci42. Gucci42 claimed to be the person behind the DNC breach. They said they were a Romanian hacker and totally 100% not at all Russian. Of course, CrowdStrike stood by its analysis. They'd found tools, IOCs, C2 infrastructure, and general tradecraft that all perfectly matched two separate Russian intelligence units. And it's funny, you know, because Julian Assange said on Twitter yesterday that malware can be repurposed by other groups. And of course, that is true. But the emulation of the tradecraft is another point, as is the C2 infrastructure used by the attackers. It's one thing to repurpose malware. It's another thing to use the same bloody CNC and PowerShell tricks. So yes, if we had to bet our lives on it, we'd say the attackers were Russian government units. So the question becomes, why bother inventing a false persona to claim credit for the attacks? If it wasn't a Russian SIGINT unit, why would the attacker use Russian tools, Russian C2, and Russian techniques, leave Russian metadata in documents they release, then deny they're Russian at the first available opportunity? That just does not make sense. Well, it kind of does. It kind of does make sense, and here's why. The Iran-backed attack against Saudi Aramco was claimed by the fictitious Cutting Sword of Justice. The North Korea-backed attack against Sony Pictures was claimed by the fictitious group Guardians of Peace. The attack against TV5 Monde in France was claimed by someone pretending to be an ISIS supporter, and that one turned out to be Russia. So what do we have here in the case of Gucci42? Well, in my mind, it's a signal, it's a communication, it's a wink and a nod. It's a veneer. It's a veneer that's thin enough for the SIGINT agencies to see through, but thick enough for the politicians in the targeted countries to hide behind. In many cases, this has become a standard operating procedure following a state-backed attack. Our first guest, as part of our DNC leaks coverage, is a journalist who played a significant role in casting doubt on the Gucci42 persona. Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai is on staff with Vice in New York, and he was able to prove with a fairly high degree of confidence that Gucci42 is not Romanian. I spoke to him via Skype.
Yeah, so, well, I first heard about the story when the Washington Post came out with their scoop, I guess at this point almost more than a month ago. And, at that point, basically the story was just that somebody had hacked into the DNC and CrowdStrike believe it was two Russian-sponsored groups, APT-28 and APT-29. And then the next day, this mysterious hacker called Gucci42 comes out of the blue, puts up a WordPress blog and a Twitter account and says, you know what, everyone is wrong here, you guys are full of shit, and I was the one that did it. And when this happened, for some reason, I think that told me that this story was bigger than... I mean, the story was already big, right? Mm. But this was like, okay, this is more complicated than everybody thought. There's something weird going on. And, you know, given the fact that Gucci42 had a certain, like, you know, exposure online or online presence, let's say, I realized that, you know, I could try to talk to him. So I thought, well, let's try to talk to him. So I sent him a DM. I noticed that he had open DMs on Twitter. And to be honest with you, like, I didn't really think he would answer. I thought that he had no reason to. There was nothing to gain. You know, he had made his claims. You know, usually my experience talking to hackers, you know, it depends. It's always like you never know. Like, some are chatty, some are not. But I just had a sort of a pessimistic approach. I thought, you know, it's worth trying, but I wasn't holding my breath. And then lo and behold, he actually responded pretty quickly. I think he answered within minutes or within an hour of my message and said, oh, sure. You know, I basically asked him, do you want to do an interview? I asked some questions. And he said, sure, you know, let's do it. And I offered to do it in other, you know, by any other mean, but he was like, no, let's do it here on Twitter. I was like, sure, okay. And, you know, I asked him a few questions. I asked him how he did it. I asked him who he was and, you know, whether he was Russian, because, you know, obviously everyone was like, well, I guess CrowdStrike could be wrong, but, you know, it seems like it could also be that this is just the Russians messing with us.
So that was basically your first line of questioning, was it? It was like, yo, are you really Russian? Like, simple as that.
Yeah. I don't remember if this was my first question, but yeah, it was among the, you know, that was one of the things that I really wanted to ask, right? That was the main thing that I wanted to ask. And when I did, he denied it. And he actually said, I don't remember the exact quote, but he basically said, I hate being attributed to Russian, to Russia. I hate Russia. And another interesting thing that I just remembered actually was that he also commented on the motive of the hack. And he said, you know, I hate that people are saying this is pro-Trump. I'm not pro-Trump. I'm not pro-Bernie Sanders. I'm just like against the Illuminati and some sort of like conspiracy theory talk that I thought was very strange.
So they just grabbed the first like batshit insane conspiracy theory and sort of threw it at you as the motivation.
Yeah, it didn't sound very well thought. You know, like for example, I'm sure you're familiar and I'm sure that your listeners are familiar with this, but I've been talking to Phineas Fisher, the hacker that broke into both Finn Fisher and Hacking Team, the notorious surveillance company, surveillance tech companies. And, you know, when I compare the two, it's just clear that, you know, one, which is Phineas Fisher, has always been very good at arguing why he's done these things, you know, and you can agree and disagree with his motives. This is not about, you know, whether we agree with them or not. It's just about the fact that he's always been very eloquent and almost extraordinarily so. You know, I haven't seen a lot of hackers argue so well about their motives. And on the other hand, and this was very like fresh in my mind because this whole Hacking Team story was still fresh in my mind when I spoke to the Guccifer. And Guccifer too just sounded like, you know, like you said, he was just like throwing whatever he thought would make a little bit of sense at me. And it seemed like his intentions was more to confuse me and sort of like, you know, deflect tension than actually really arguing why he did it. You know, I would have believed him more if he had said, oh, you know, I just did it for the lulz.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, pulling out the Illuminati or lizard people stuff like that is basically the, yeah, not entirely convincing. Now, you managed to trip up Guccifer 2.0, didn't you? Because when he was pretending, or the, whoever was behind that account was pretending to be Romanian, they didn't exactly expect you to have a handy way to be able to verify or check his claims during the interview, but you'd put a bit of thought into it, hadn't you?
Yeah, it was kind of like, to be honest, it was kind of an instinctive move. I was like, okay, you're saying you're Romanian. Let's, you know, talk to me in Romanian. And, you know, I don't know Romanian. And as a lot of people quickly pointed out, my Romanian in that chat transcript was awful. But, you know, it was awful because I used Google Translate and I wasn't really interested in like showing off my Romanian skills, which are non-existent. I was like interested in his Romanian skills. So, and it turns out, you know, I obviously immediately I had no idea if his Romanian was good, but because I had no, you know, no way to check it. But what I noticed was that his answers were really short. And so at some point I was like, okay, let's try to see. I was like, can you tell me exactly how you did this in Romanian, like step by step? And at that point, he basically, you know, he just said, well, oh, you know, you're wasting my time. I think this is not worth it. I already told you that in English. Like, why do you want? Why do you care? Blah, blah, blah. And he essentially cut me off and soon he, you know, he left the interview, essentially. It's like the equivalent of, like, you know, getting up from your chair and leaving the interview room.
Yeah, now this seems to me to be a pretty solid data point to suggest that this guy is not Romanian.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, once the interview was over and it was clear that he wasn't answering my questions anymore, I reached out to a few Romanians, including security researchers and also a tech reporter based in Romania that sometimes has written for us. And I asked them, so these are native speakers. I was like, what do you think about this Romanian? Yeah, because I have no way of knowing if this is good or not. And they were like, okay, this is definitely not a Romanian speaker. Like nobody had even flinched. You know, as soon as they saw the transcript, they were like, yeah, this is not a Romanian. And, you know, we have to say this doesn't mean that the guy is Russian, but it just means that his cover story denying being Russia is false.
Well, I mean, the whole thing's a little bit strange from the point of view of, well, why would you perfectly emulate Russian tradecraft and then deny your Russian at the first available opportunity? There's still a lot about this that doesn't quite add up, isn't there?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think that it's fair to say that nobody knows for sure whether the whole hack was done by the Russian government and whether Guccifer 2 was Russian. It's just that all the signs point in that direction. And also, as you said, like, it just makes no sense if you're trying to, you know, if you're like trying to deny being Russian, then why would you leave Russian breadcrumbs and also then put out a cover story that doesn't, you know, that immediately crumbles? I mean, his cover story of being Romanian crumbled immediately. And also another point that I don't think I ever made, like, in writing, and I've been trying to make by talking to people this week, is, you know, even the choice of his nickname is a little strange. You know, it doesn't prove anything, but I think it's strange because, you know, hackers, like lone hackers, like he claimed to be a lone hacker, right? He claimed to be sort of like an hacktivist, what we would call an activist. So hacktivists usually do these sort of things, you know, make these public claims to brag, right? The whole motive is brag and be like, hey, look how cool I am. I hacked the DNC. So why would you choose a nickname that's already in use? Why would you not, like, choose something that's more unique, that, you know, that will help your brand, for lack of a better word?
Better? Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, there is just a lot that doesn't add up. But I'm guessing after your experience of actually having some contact with Guccifer 2, that you'd be fairly confident that Russia was behind this. That's my guess.
Yeah, I'm still very confident. And, you know, I still might be wrong. You know, I don't have the... I'm not an intelligence officer, and, you know, I'm ready to eat my crow or whatever if it turns out I'm wrong. But I think that at this point in time, I think that every sign points in that direction. And, you know, unfortunately, we might never know. We might never see a smoking gun. I mean, you know, let's face it, we never saw a smoking gun in the Sony hack. We never saw a smoking gun even in the Stuxnet attack. But, you know, there have been occasions in which attribution is at this point more or less accepted, and I think this might be one of them.
Look, you know, as you pointed out, this story first broke in mid-June between, you know, the DNC allowing CrowdStrike to release elements of their investigation, elements of the results of their investigation, and a Washington Post write-up. Why was this not taken seriously at the time? Because it's just been mind-boggling this week to see the attention it's now getting. Why didn't it kick off the first time?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm afraid I don't have a really good answer. But, you know, that was one of the things that actually frustrated me in the past few weeks. You know, when this came out, it was clear it was a big story. When there were signs that this Guccifer 2 was just an attempt to cover up, that made the story even bigger. Because, you know, like, I think it's important to remind everyone that governments hacking other governments, or, you know, government-related targets, that's pretty normal. You know, it's espionage, clear, you know, classic
espionage.
Yeah, but
dropping it all to WikiLeaks isn't really standard operating procedure.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
So, yeah, dropping documents to WikiLeaks, creating a public persona that leaks documents, that's definitely not standard. Like, we haven't seen it before. And I know that a lot of skeptics are like, well, the U.S. has tried to influence elections in the past too. Yes, true. But they've never done it this way. And, you know, this would be really, you know, a first of its kind in the history of cyberspace. So that was, you know, even last week, I remember talking to friends and other people, and I'm like, I can't believe that this is, like, nobody cares about this. You know, it's a big deal. And then everyone started caring about it. And I think it's because WikiLeaks was very good at timing this. You know, they released their emails on Friday, the day after Trump was nominated, just a couple of days before the Democratic convention. You know, the timing, the PR strategy there was perfect on Julian Assange's side. That was the perfect time to get the attention, and, you know, and that's why we're still talking about it.
Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about your work on this story. It's excellent work. I really do appreciate your work on this one. Thanks again.
Thanks so much, Patrick, and it's been a pleasure to be here with you.
That was Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai there. Big thanks to him. It's worth pointing out that linguistic analysis has also indicated Guccifer 2 is Russian. Okay, so we're going to continue now on the basis that this is a Russian operation. We're going to make that assumption. We're going to make that leap, which leads us to the next thing we need to consider in all of this, the why. Why would Russia do this? The prevailing commentary says this is all about NATO. Putin wants Trump in power to weaken NATO and weaken America. But remember, this is Russia we're talking about. This is the country that hacked a French television station and then claimed to be the Islamic State, the sworn enemy of Russia's ally Bashar al-Assad. This is the country that employs countless people to work as Twitter eggs, trolls pumping out disinformation and weird politics 24/7. This is the country that imported ideas from conceptual art and brought them into the heart of politics and propaganda. Now, around the time of the TV5 Monde attack, I played some audio from a short film by Adam Curtis on non-linear warfare that helps to explain Russia's approach to propaganda. Now, in light of what's been happening, I think we need to hear it again. The film describes Putin's strategy for controlling the agenda in Russia. His right-hand man, Vladislav Surkov, has completely changed the propaganda game. The BBC's Adam Curtis explains.
His aim is to undermine people's perception of the world, so they never know what is really happening. Surkov turned Russian politics into a bewildering, constantly changing piece of theatre. He sponsored all kinds of groups, from neo-Nazi skinheads to liberal human rights groups. He even backed parties that were opposed to President Putin. But the key thing was that Surkov then let it be known that this was what he was doing, which meant that no one was sure what was real or fake. As one journalist put it, it's a strategy of power that keeps any opposition constantly confused. A ceaseless shape-shifting that is unstoppable because it's indefinable. Which is exactly what Surkov is alleged to have done in the Ukraine this year. In typical fashion, as the war began, Surkov published a short story about something he called non-linear war. A war where you never know what the enemy are really up to, or even who they are. The underlying aim, Surkov says, is not to win the war, but to use the conflict to create a constant state of destabilized perception, in order to manage and control.
So, why is Russia doing this? Are its SIGINT agencies being tasked with influence missions? Or is this part of a bigger brief, cause chaos, confuse everyone? Is this a demonstration of capability, like North Korea's attack against Sony Pictures? Maybe yes, maybe no, maybe go f*** yourself. That's the whole point. We don't know why, and we're not supposed to. It's entirely possible Putin has given his government and other so-called patriots his strategic objectives and then cut them loose to pursue them opportunistically. In fact, the Washington Post today quoted former CIA director Michael Hayden as saying the motivation may simply be to disrupt and discredit the US political process without seeking any particular result. Here's a direct quote. Frankly, I don't think they're motivated by thinking they can affect the election itself. I'm going to quote from the piece here. The Russians, already masters at information dominance or using information as a political and military weapon, may be flexing their muscles to demonstrate that they can, not necessarily to make Trump win or Hillary lose. Putin knows stirring up the mob is an excellent way to control the agenda. They're so busy fighting each other that they don't pay attention to what you're doing. That's why he funds left-wing and right-wing groups. The more fanatical, the better. But why would Russia do this to the DNC? Well, we don't know, and we're not supposed to know. We're supposed to run around like headless chickens trying to figure it out, and it's working. Now, this brings us to WikiLeaks' role in all of this. It's now blindingly obvious that the WikiLeaks model is flawed. If you allow yourself to become a document laundering service, let's face it, you're going to wind up doing the bidding of those who can obtain the most sensational stolen documents. Russia has turned WikiLeaks into Russia Today without the logo. Whether Julian Assange knows that WikiLeaks is functioning as a cutout for Russian intelligence doesn't really matter. The point is, the concept, the very idea of bulletproof hosting for stolen documents has been repurposed as a tool of state-backed agenda manipulation. In retrospect, it's quite obvious that WikiLeaks was always destined to become a tool of the powerful. And we should have seen it coming, because more or less the same thing that's happening to the DNC right now has happened before. In 2009, WikiLeaks dumped the so-called ClimateGate emails, messages stolen from the University of East Anglia and uploaded to a server in Russia. That attack is widely believed to be the work of Russian intelligence. The emails were published by WikiLeaks right before the 2009 Copenhagen Climate Summit, a summit Russia did not want to succeed. When all the dust settled, the emails didn't disprove climate science. What they did was give temporarily effective ammunition to the doubters and create a perception of scandal that effectively sank the summit. Is Russia using doxing and other digital efforts as an explicit foreign policy tactic? Maybe. Perhaps these actions aren't non-linear, and we just don't understand what the f*** they're up to and what their objectives are. But we do know they're using WikiLeaks. Kevin Paulson is a contributing editor at Wired and a longtime WikiLeaks watcher. He was briefly at the centre of the WikiLeaks controversy when he broke the story of Bradley Manning's arrest in 2010, now Chelsea Manning. In 2012, following the publication of Stratfor's emails by WikiLeaks, Kevin appeared on this show and predicted WikiLeaks would become a document laundering service. What neither of us saw coming was WikiLeaks acting as the extension of an intelligence apparatus. I spoke to him this week to collect his thoughts on WikiLeaks in light of these recent developments.
You know, we also don't know the context of how Julian got this and whether there were strings attached. He's always shown a lot of deference to the will or the wishes of the source. So it may well be that part of the deal that he struck with his source in this case was that he publish everything, that he not take out so much as a social security number of a Democratic donor. And that's why he just pushed it all out there. Looking back to this interview that we did 4 years ago, what I saw coming was that WikiLeaks was going to turn itself into an outlet for hacked data. For just dumping hacked data onto the web. And I thought that the people who would be using that, taking advantage of that, would be hacktivists like Jeremy Hammond, groups like Anonymous, waging a kind of asymmetric warfare against whoever they perceive as the enemy. What I didn't see coming, as you so thoughtfully pointed out, was that governments would follow that model themselves. And that's a really interesting development. That's the killer app now for a site like WikiLeaks, is laundering information for state actors who are using their access for their own ends. So that's the big story. And then the chicanery at the DNC with favoring Hillary over Bernie Sanders, like all of that, that's a good sidebar. That'd be a great sidebar to the story, or a second story. It could run alongside and slightly below the first one. But yeah, the fact that these are the Russians trying to swing the election, that is definitely the bigger story. But if you're Julian Assange, you can't do that story, right? I mean, because then the Russians aren't going to come to you again, and other governments aren't going to come to you, and you're squeezing yourself out of your last best hope for remaining relevant in an age where all the major news outlets have their own secure submission systems. Like, you have to distinguish yourself in some way, and being the guys that'll take data from anybody and will publish it without any kind of safeguards, that puts him gives him a unique footing. So you could see why, given his interests, he would go that route. Julian has always been very good at kind of testing the ideology and the loyalties of his fans. Like, ever since he went into exile to avoid a rape case, if you support WikiLeaks, like, the burden of other things that you're supporting that may run counter to your core beliefs just grows and grows year after year as Assange does more and more stuff. So now he is testing his supporters once again in a big way. And I think it's taking a toll on WikiLeaks. You could see people losing patience with Julian on Twitter and elsewhere. And that's been kind of developing for a long time, and it's coming to a head now.
The voice of Kevin Paulson there, rounding out this week's coverage of the DNC leaks. I really do hope you found something valuable in all of that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Simon Crosby, the CTO and co-founder of Bromium. Bromium makes some very, very compelling technology. Their flagship product is basically micro virtualization tech. So you can think of it as like cubes for Windows. It provides a level of like memory corruption exploit mitigation and general protection that you basically can't find in other products, in non-virtualization based products. So, you know, if you've got those sorts of problems that can be solved by this tech, you really need to have a look. Bromium has also recently moved into the EDR space, endpoint detection and response, and there too, they actually have some pretty unique capabilities. I'll give you a quick example. If something on a user's machine blows up the microvisor, the EDR component kicks into gear and searches the whole network for other instances of whatever caused the problem. Now, that's just not a capability you're going to find in non-microvisor-based products. So I guess what I'm trying to say is Bromium stuff is actually quite different to the usual security products out there. Now, it might not be what you're looking for, but it does solve some problems that other people can't. They're not everyone's problems, but they're unique problems, and Bromium has a unique solution. Anyway, this week we are talking to Simon about his dealings with Tavis Ormandy, Destroyer of Worlds. Bromium issued a challenge before an InfoSec conference in Europe. Basically, they said if anyone could infect their demo box with malware, they'd get £10,000. And of course, no one was able to infect their box. At that point, Tavis decided to get involved. He obtained a copy of the software and found a bug in it. And it's very impressive work, it has to be said, but it actually didn't meet the criteria for the £10,000 challenge because, like, as you'll hear, the software he was using was actually a custom build for one user for testing purposes, and it wasn't deployed in a real environment with default policies. Nonetheless, Tavis took to Twitter saying he'd donate the £10,000 to Amnesty International if Bromium paid up. And not only did Bromium pay, Simon actually matched Tavis's donation out of his own pocket. Simon joined me to talk about the whole experience of dealing with a Tavis bug from the vendor side. And as I said at the top of the show, this is an absolute cracker of an interview. Here's Simon.
So first of all, we're just little Bromium, right? And here's Tavis. He's the god of breaking stuff. So we're not Symantec, right? We're not the big evil monster and everything else. So just getting his attention was pretty awesome. How did his attention happen? Well, we were going into InfoSec Europe, and our goal was really this. We wanted people to show up with whatever malware they had, throw it at our stuff, and then take it around the show and get other vendors, ask other vendors to run on their stuff too. And so we had issued this challenge: show up, and if you manage to break us, we'll hand out £10,000. We also want you to go and take your latest malware to other vendors at the show, and we guarantee you that nobody else will let you run your stuff on their products because they just don't know if those products work. So that was the challenge that we issued, and then Tavis popped up saying, "Hey, I found a bug." Now, the interesting thing was we hadn't given Tavis our software. And so it turned out that he had found a copy of it in VirusTotal.
Now, what, a copy of your software in VirusTotal? How does that work?
This is the coolest part of the story. So it turned out that this was a build that was produced for just one customer to test a feature. They were downloading it, and their web gateway said, "Huh, this is kind of weird. I'm going to upload it to VirusTotal and see if they think it's okay." VirusTotal kept a copy of it. And so then, you know, Tavis went off and found it there. But the corollary there is quite mind-boggling. There are web gateways out there, which will shall remain nameless, which regularly do this. If they see stuff coming in the enterprise, they just upload it to VirusTotal and go and see. And so if you have a login to VirusTotal, you can go and find all sorts of cool stuff, including confidential documents.
That's another story, and probably you've planted a bit of a seed with a bunch of the listeners there. So next thing you know, you're getting a tweet from Tavis saying there's a bug.
Yes. So I'm going to be very clear about the bug versus the stuff which he's done versus Symantec, right? So Bromium's number one claim to fame is that we massively reduced the attack surface, right, of the endpoint. And so everything that Tavis did is, in fact, first of all, required. That is, you want the world's best to have a go at it and either find stuff or find nothing. But nonetheless, that's the only way of ever proving that you're doing a good job. That is, there's no way I can say my signatures are better than everybody else's, or my detector has better heuristics or whatever, all the bullshit that the antivirus folks use. The only claim you have is that you've done a better job of reducing the attack surface. Okay.
Yeah.
And so the whole model has always been, don't believe me, believe other people. The bug that he found was really interesting. So it turned out that there was a bug in Chrome 51. And I don't know that specifically Tavis had found it or fixed it, but certainly he knew about it at Google. And the version of the software that he had a prepackaged Chromium isolation capability for Chrome 51 packaged in it. We were already on to Chrome 56 or something, much further on. No, whatever. We were two versions further on. So if you knew about the bug in Chrome and you knew another couple of other bugs, you could chain them together. So, for example, you'd have to break out of the Chrome sandbox, then take advantage of the Chrome bug, which really allowed there's a hidden resource type called a res URL. And if we had a bug in the way we parsed the URL strings there, so that a micro VM, which was isolating a Chrome renderer instance, could mistakenly relay a resource request up to the host Chrome browser. And if you then knew how to break into the host Chrome browser, you could get it to download some additional software, break out the browser, and then on the host. Net, you'd need to have a chain of four bugs which you put together in order to be able to break through this thing. And that was because we had a parsing error in the way we parsed the URLs. That should never have been allowed. And so he found that, by the way, that bug was common also to IE. So he really served us enormously well by finding that common error, which had been just introduced in that version 3.1 of our product. So net, he found this way of essentially attacking the host by taking advantage of the fact that we were misparsing a particular resource URL, which could allow you to, download malware or do other things on the host. So it was totally cool.
And you wound up, instead of giving the cash to him, it went to Amnesty International. How did that come about?
So Tavis popped up and he said, hey, I have this bug, and if they pay me the bounty, I'm going to donate it to Amnesty. Okay. And then right after that, somebody else on Twitter popped up and said, yeah, Chromium will never pay up or something equivalent to that. And I said, well, should we will? I'll double it. And so off we went down the path of going off to reproduce it. By the way, just this is a good appropriate time to say that everything that Tavis did was meticulously professional. This dude was brilliant in the way we dealt with him during the issue. So I have nothing other than praise for him. And at the end of it all, I had said, we double it and everything else. We chose to do that, but it was very important to make a difference to say that there was a difference between this crazy build, which had shown up in VirusTotal, and the build that we were using at InfoSec. Moreover, our builds that go out are configured for demo. They're not configured with production deployment policies. So actually, it turns out that any production deployment of our software would have mitigated the bug that he had, because there's no way that the host Chrome could ever have sent packets to the internet or anything else. Okay, so there were, in general, deployment policies would have meant that you couldn't take advantage of the bug anyway. So we wanted to draw the line between the InfoSec challenge, which is really about malware, and also having one of the most skilled people on the planet have a go at the software, which is something we want. So just want to be very clear. We as Chromium want to be able to say malware has never broken this thing, which as far as I'm aware is still the case. But we also want it to be the case that we can say the world's best hackers are continually applying their skills to make it better.
So hang on, let me just back up on you there for a second. So basically, in a real world deployment of your software, this would have been mitigated. It would not have been exploitable.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Why didn't you? Now I'm just curious here, and I understand that there's a lot of mob rule on Twitter and stuff like that. I feel I know the answer to the question I'm about to ask, but why didn't you push back harder on that? And why didn't you say, well, come on, do you know what I mean? This is a one off build that we did for a customer. It doesn't affect real-world deployments, give me a break. Why is it that you didn't do that? Is it because you feared a bit of a backlash because vendors that are seen to be dismissive of researchers generally don't fare so well in the PR game?
I certainly think that the community, the securities community on Twitter you know, thinks the vendors are all full of bullshit. But let's be honest, the vendors lie. Okay, every vendor lies as much as they can about their product. And since day one, we have tried to take the opposite approach by saying, don't believe me. I'm going to tell you that my product's awesome. Please don't believe me. Believe somebody you trust. And then when people who have credibility in the community come along and say, hey, I found a thing, you can't pour cold water on them. You're in, right? You got to go down that path. And so for me, this is a very fundamental issue. The only way we can make the industry better is by giving people who have the cred, who've done the work, who've done the research, give them the credit for what they've done and then own it and then go do better.
So end result of this wound up being a very, very peaceful, announcement about this bug and, lots of soft and fluffies from, what was it, £20,000 in the end went to Amnesty?
Yeah. We have only one thing to thank then, that is, you know, the Brits were going through Brexit, so it ended up cheaper than it might have been at the start.
That's very considerate of them. No, that's great. So 20,000 quid off to Amnesty International. Tavis seemed to be pretty happy about that. You guys seem to be actually, quite interested in his research. I'm curious, though, have you now provided him with official builds? Will you be doing that with other researchers? Because it seems like in this case, someone did get their greasy mitts all over it, and what they found was very interesting, and it was a legit bug, kind of mitigated in the real world, but still a legit bug that you needed to fix. Will you be now more aggressively sort of providing builds to researchers so that they can have a crack at it? Because I know it's a difficult line to walk, right, when you're pushing this stuff out there. How aggressively do you want to put it out there?
Very aggressively, provided that we respect our customers' need, which is to ensure that they are protected, right? That
so is as long in as general, people don't go around being dickheads and dropping ODA, you're okay with it?
Actually, in general, we don't want people announcing bugs on Twitter ahead of doing the responsible disclosure thing. So to my mind, there's always this gray line between white hat and black hat. Ultimately, to my mind, the decision point is, did you follow the rules of responsible disclosure, let people fix stuff, and advise their customers so that they could remain protected before you went off and told the world? If you're going to go down that path, I'm all over it.
But how do you enforce that? Because hackers hate signing documents that say that sort of thing. They hate any sort of restriction. So how are you planning on mitigating that?
I don't know. I'm open to advice. But right now, what I can tell you is that, certainly Tavis was the role model of it. He was brilliant at it. And it was fun interacting with him during the 2 weeks when he was trying to reproduce our fixes and a whole bunch of other things. We've always had a small stable of kind of friendly white hats who've had access and who do whatever they can, but they aren't spending their time actively trying to break the product. And so until now, before this incident, the only thing we could have done was to go and pay a reputable agency to go and have a crack at it. So, for example, IOActive or so on. But in general, some model which allows us to ensure that our customers are protected, we're all over.
So would you consider running a bounty program on the actual software?
Sure. But it has to be one in which those rules of responsible disclosure are respected.
That was Bromium co-founder and CTO Simon Crosby there. And as I say, Bromium stuff is quite different. Do go have a look at it at bromium.com. Again, big thanks to Bromium for sponsoring this week's show. And thanks to Simon for sharing that story this week. It was, I found it very interesting. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.